This is VOA News via remote. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. President Donald Trump called on the United Nations to hold China accountable for their actions in a speech to the world body's General Assembly Tuesday. In a pre-recorded speech from the White House, Mr. Trump blamed the Chinese government for the global spread of COVID-19, which has now infected 31 million people worldwide and killed more than 965,000. The U.S. death toll has now topped 200,000. In his recorded remarks, Chinese President Xi Jinping said any attempt to politicize the pandemic should be rejected, and the World Health Organization should be given a leading role in the international response to the coronavirus. Trump has been harshly criticized for his handling of the pandemic, including from some former officials of his own administration. President Trump's mocking of his Democratic presidential rival, Joe Biden, for wearing a face mask in public took on a personal tone Tuesday night at a rally in Pittsburgh. Trump said, why did he spend all that money on the plastic surgery if he's going to cover it up with a mask? Trump and Biden have been at odds over the value of face masks as a defense against the coronavirus. And speaking of the president, he said he plans to announce on Saturday his nominee for the Supreme Court vacancy left by the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Mr. Trump earlier said his choice will be one of five conservative women on his short list. He met with one of them, possibly Judge Amy Coney Barrett, whom the president appointed to her current position. Via remote, this is VOA News. The woman accused of sending a ricin-laced letter to President Trump was formally charged Tuesday with threatening the president of the United States. At a court in Buffalo, New York, Pascal Theria requested a court-appointed attorney. U.S. Magistrate Judge Kenneth Schroeder then entered a not guilty plea on her behalf. According to an FBI affidavit, a note in the ricin-laced letter to the president read, and I'm quoting now, I found a new name for you, the ugly tyrant clown. I hope you like it. Affidavit said investigators found six additional letters sent to Texas in mid-December, maybe then mid-September, to people staffing detention centers where Ferrier was held in 2019 after an arrest for weapons possession. She's deemed a flight risk and will be held in detention until a special hearing coming up on September 29th. A spokesman for the European Union Council President Charles Michel says a summit of European Union leaders scheduled for Thursday and Friday has been postponed after Michel was forced to go into COVID-19 quarantine following a contact with an infected security guard. The summit, now scheduled for October 1st through the 2nd, will focus on issues ranging from Brexit negotiations to climate change and the tensions between Greece and Turkey over energy rights on the eastern Mediterranean island nation of Cyprus. Participants also expected to consider final approval for sanctions against Belarus regarding the crackdown following last month's disputed presidential election. Police in Cameroon used tear gas water cannons to disperse protesters Tuesday, calling for an end to President Paul Biya's near 40-year rule. Protests called by Biya's rival, Maurice Kamto, of the Cameroon Renaissance Movement Party, who hopes to spark a popular revolt. Biya, also under pressure from young political activists in urban centers who want change and say the 87-year-old has stolen elections and is the mastermind of a series of deadly backlashes against those who oppose him. More pilot whales found stranded in the area of Australia's coast on Wednesday, raising the total to almost 500 at the lost mass stranding ever recorded in the island state of Tasmania. Authorities have been working to rescue survivors among an estimated 270 whales found on Monday on a beach in two sandbars near the remote west coast town of Strahan. Tasmania is the only part of Australia prone to mass strandings, that is. For more news, join us, voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Gambia's parliament rejects a draft constitution.
The votes of the honorable members supporting the reading of the bill failed short of the threshold of 42 members.
Liberia's Nobel laureate Lema Mbowe unveils an anti-violence campaign. We'll tell you why Kenya's Chief Justice asked President Kenyatta to dissolve Parliament. The women of Southern Cameroon commemorate the third Takumben Day. And the UN wants African schools reopened during the coronavirus.
We acknowledge the safe reopening of school will not be easy. It will not be a practice in perfection, but it can be done with community commitment, government leadership, and investment.
A new report looks at land and biodiversity protection in Africa. Village stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Gambia's parliament on Tuesday rejected the country's draft constitution. The proposed constitution was meant to replace the country's 1997 constitution, but parliament failed to garner the necessary votes to approve it. Pandere Umbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
After days of intensive debate on the 2017 draft constitution, Parliament has finally decided to reject the proposed new law. Mariam Jack Denton is the Speaker of the National Assembly.
Honorable members, please, these are the results. The ayes, 31. The noes, 23.
The rejected new law was supposed to replace the 1997 constitution, which was passed during former President Yahya Jammeh's rule. Some of the MPs who are on President Barrow's camp refused to vote in favor of the bill. They said the proposed law was designed to operate retroactively. According to the MPs, President Barrow's current five-year mandate would be included in the two-term limit for the presidency as stipulated by the draft constitution. Speaker Denton again.
According to Section 2262B and 4B of the 1997 Constitution reads, and I quote, subsection 2, subject to section 4, a bill for an act of the National Assembly under this section, that is section 226, shall not be passed by the Assembly or presented to the President for assent unless 2B, the bill is supported on the second and third readings by the votes of not less than 3/4 of all the members of the National Assembly.
Opposition leader Oshin Odabo has made repeated calls prior to Tuesday's vote for the MPs to pass the bill, but to no avail. Another opposition leader, Mai Ahmed Fati, even took to Facebook crying while expressing the need for the bill to be passed. Efforts made by the European Union, the United States Embassy, Banjul, and the British High Commission for the bill to be passed had also failed.
The votes of the honorable members supporting the reading of the bill failed short of the threshold of 42 members. Therefore, as presiding officer and in accordance with section 2262B and 4B of the 1997 constitution, I hereby announce that the constitution of the Republic of the Gambia 2020 promulgation bill 2020 fails and would not proceed to the next stage of the process.
Dauda Jallo is Gambia's justice minister.
The flip side is, if we get a no answer at this stage, a no vote, by my own interpretation of section 226 of the current constitution, and I intimated earlier, a no answer at this stage kills the bill right here. That is my interpretation.
Now that the new law has suffered a premature death in parliament, the country's future remains uncertain. Observers say the opposition might not take the rejection of the bill lightly. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Liberia's Nobel laureate Lema Mbowe has announced a campaign against election-related violence in Liberia. This comes as the country is preparing for what promises to be a hotly contested senatorial midterm elections. Mbowe says her foundation will enlist the services of hundreds of young peace ambassadors to lead the campaign in their neighborhoods. Bowie says that young people will do it voluntarily because, as she puts it, you cannot buy peace, you can work for peace. She says her message to both the ruling Congress for Democratic Change and the opposition, as well as their supporters, is please do not touch the peace of the Liberian people.
You see, we come from a nation that has a history of violence. Every time we come to an election circle, we have pockets of violence and lives. Sometimes are lost, properties are damaged. And this circle, come December 2020, we are beginning to see signs of violence again. It is based on all of these backgrounds that my foundation decided, let's start something that will target particularly the young people. And this campaign is going to be led by 660 of these young people. The theme of the campaign is Don't Touch My Peace. And we decided to personalize it because we know that peace is very important to the life and livelihood of every individual in Liberia.
Ms. Bowie, you are in Ghana right now. And so how would you implement this campaign?
Being in Ghana doesn't limit me. Yesterday, we launched a campaign with young people from Montserrado, Magibi, and Bon counties on the virtual platform. Next week or this week, young people will be in different areas from churches to mosques, just giving 1 minute statements to adults to say that, please don't touch my peace. Peace is very important. But also within the communities, they will be sitting with their peers and having conversations about not getting involved in violence during the elections process.
When I first read the article, it says that you want to utilize youth peace ambassadors. How would this work? Will you pay them or will they work on voluntary basis?
Mr. Boate, how different will I be from the tailors who paid young people $20 to fight, to the politicians who are paying young people $20 to buy their vote? How different would I be if I am one of those individuals reinforcing the culture of the infamous $20? I believe that it's time for us in our country to move away from paying for things that would benefit the society. You can't buy peace. You can work for peace. And by working for peace, you ensure that you have a future. Of course, when young people are in the field working, there is a need for them to have water to drink, transportation to go to where they need to go to. And that's not buying peace. Having lunch together to eat in communities to share the peace or to talk about peace. Those are the kinds of things. But to pay people to work for peace is basically saying to our children, we have no confidence in your ability to do any good in the future, so we have to keep paying you. I have so much belief in the young people of our nation.
Liberia will vote in midterm elections this December. What is your message to the ruling party and opposition and their supporters?
The message is, please don't touch the peace of the Liberian people. We know that these are highly contested elections, but the whole burden of sustaining the peace of Liberia rests squarely on the shoulder of the ruling party because they are the government of the day. For the opposition, we've also seen that they are not angels because the primaries in Nima points to, they too have tendency to go to wars or to do some fist fight and go into violence. We're urging them to conduct themselves peacefully.
Ms. Bowie, thank you very much again. We're so grateful to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Boate, and please be safe.
That was Liberia's Nobel laureate, Lema Bowie, speaking with us from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Schools across Africa are slowly reopening after months of remote learning during the coronavirus pandemic. But Zimbabwe's Teachers Union is resisting going back to the classroom and has rejected a call by the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, for governments to reopen schools. Columbus Mavonga reports from Harare.
On Tuesday, Mohamed Malik Fall, Regional Director for UNICEF in Eastern and Southern Africa, urged governments in the region to open schools closed earlier this year following an outbreak of coronavirus. Fall says the pandemic has caused an unprecedented education crisis over the last 7 months as radio and online learning methods are not reaching all the students. Some also lost the daily meals they were receiving at school. And that's not all, says Fall.
Lost learning hurts children and community. Teenage pregnancy and violence against children increase. Now we acknowledge the safe reopening of school will not be easy. And while the evidence shows children are not the main driver of the pandemic, there will be cases of COVID-19 in school. It will not be a practice in perfection, but it can be done with community commitment, government leadership, and investment.
South Africa, despite its large COVID-19 caseloads, reopened schools for all grades at the end of August. UNICEF says most countries in Eastern and Southern Africa have seen a first return to schools, starting with exam classes. In Zimbabwe, exam classes are scheduled to start next week, but that hangs in balance after the country's biggest teachers' union called for a strike unless their concerns are addressed. The teachers earn about $100 a month, including a $75 COVID-19 allowance introduced 2 months ago. They want an additional $500 to be above the poverty line. Sifiso Ndlovu, the head of the Zimbabwe Teachers Association, says he's worried that UNICEF has not looked at his country's lack of preparedness to reopen schools.
The safety issues that we have been concerned about in the schools have not been met thoroughly as to guarantee safe and healthy reopening of schools without high incidence of COVID-19. Secondly, UNICEF seems to be oblivious that the learning conditions for students is also dependent on the working conditions of the teachers. And above all, it should be supported by sound budgetary support, even from UNICEF.
Amoni Murwira is Zimbabwe's Minister of Higher and Tertiary Education. He says the government allocated about $60,000 to ensure that when schools reopen, they are observing World Health Organization guidelines for COVID-19. Neighboring Zambia opened schools Monday. Via WhatsApp, Christopher Yalukanda from the Zambia National Union of Teachers said his organization is checking on the preparedness of schools after the over half a year long closures.
What we found in schools is that most of the children came back equipped with masks. The schools have already acquired some face masks, sanitizers, and also they have set up washing points within the school. In order to take care of social distancing, schools have divided or have a staggering timetable, which means that not all the learners will report to school the same day.
He said it was too early to conclude that Zambia has successfully reopened schools and is following WHO guidelines to contain the coronavirus. He said the teachers' union would go around the country to assess the situation. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 23rd. Kenya's Chief Justice David Maraga this week asked President Uhuru Kenyatta to dissolve Parliament due to Parliament's continued failure to enact the two-thirds gender representation rule. Justice Maraga says his request was in response to six petitions seeking his advice on the matter. As Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, the advisory has attracted different reactions.
Speaking in Nairobi after a Parliamentary Service Commission meeting on Tuesday, National Assembly Speaker Justin Muturi said Maraga's advice to President Uhuru Kenyatta is premature and unconditional and could plunge the country into a constitutional crisis. Muturi added that the Parliamentary Service Commission, which he chairs, will challenge the move in court.
The Commission has taken the firm position that the action by the Right Honourable Chief Justice to advise His Excellency the President as aforesaid is ill-advised, premature and unconstitutional, and is a recipe for plunging the country into a constitutional crisis of monumental proportions. The Commission notes with disappointment that the Chief Justice has ignored fundamental issues that go to the root of the fabric and structure of our Constitution in advising the President to dissolve Parliament. In the meantime, the Parliament Service Commission is convinced that the present matter shall be resolved lawfully and calls for calm and sobriety.
On the other hand, section of leaders lauded the Chief Justice for his action. Nelson Harvey, president of the Law Society of Kenya, while speaking to KTN News, said that the dissolution of parliament is a grave matter and the president must act within 21 days. He added that if the president ignores the Chief Justice's advice, anything transacted by the National Assembly members thereafter will become invalid. Harvey says the Treasury will also cease to remit any salaries and allowances to the members of parliament.
The dissolution of parliament is a grave issue. It's an issue which the people of Kenya engraved in the constitution itself to ensure that parliamentarians follow. Effective today, therefore, the parliament of Kenya is in office unconstitutionally. The president must therefore act within a period of 21 days. If the president ignores the CJ's advice, effective today, any laws passed by the National Assembly and the Senate are of no effect. They are null and void ab initio. More fundamentally, Treasury must henceforth cease remitting salaries and all other allowances to members of Parliament.
The Chief Justice made the decision after six petitioners filed suits seeking to have him dissolve the Parliament for failing to meet the legal threshold of membership. Parliament blatantly failed to do so despite four court orders compelling the parliament to enact the legislation. The legislature's fate now hangs on the decision by President Uhuru Kenyatta. Meanwhile, Kenyans are eagerly awaiting the president's move. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
The women of Southern Cameroon commemorated the third anniversary of Takumba yesterday, Tuesday. Jesse Engu Itambi is a member of the Social Justice Women's Movement of Southern Cameroon.
Takumbeng Day is a day that commemorates or celebrates the bravery, the strength of the Southern Cameroon's women. And today is actually its third anniversary, going back to 22nd of September 2017, when the women were actually called out by their revolutionary leader, Sisiku Ayoktabe, to come out and lead a peaceful protest, calling for a peaceful resolution to the crisis in Southern Cameroon.
As you know, Southern Cameroon, or we say here, English-speaking regions, have been embroiled in this conflict. It's gone on now for 3 or 4 years. What really is the role of women in this conflict? Is it one of dialogue for peacemaking, or do you support the movement?
First of all, yes, the genocide has been going on for the past 4 years, but that's not when it started. From 1961, the Southern Cameroonians have been killed, or as you put it, people from English-speaking Cameroon have been massacred. They have been killed. There's never been a single year that has gone by without the people from Southern Cameroon paying the price for having voted to get into a confederation with French Cameroon. Now, the past 4 years, things have simply come to a head. When people have had enough, you know, when you push people to the wall and give them no alternative, the only thing they have to do is to fight back. And that's how Southern Cameroonians feel. And they didn't fight back. All they're doing is defending themselves. So the role of Southern Cameroonian women in this crisis that we find ourselves is that of peace, but there can never be peace without justice. The Southern Cameroonian women are asking for justice to be served, and for justice to be served, this crisis needs to be addressed by going back to the root causes of it, by going back to 1961. That is the only way that this crisis can be resolved.
There are those who are concerned about violence on both sides of the conflict in the English-speaking region. What's your view about this violence?
My view about this violence is that in an era of unrest, of war, as it is, of genocide, there is bound to be people that take advantage of the insecurity and the chaotic nature of affairs and do whatever they have to do. We strongly, as Southern Cameroon's women, and especially as Southern Cameroon's Women's League, we strongly condemn the violence that is meted out on our people, especially the violence on our women and children. And we condemn that on both sides. We do know, and I'm going to say that there have been some instances where some of our people have had to harass or kidnap our own people, and that is strongly condemned. And there are measures being put in place now to ensure that that is sorted out.
Jesse Engu Itambi is a member of Takumbang, a social justice women's movement of Southern Cameroon. She was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. A new report by a group of researchers looks at what land and biodiversity is protected by indigenous, local, and Afro-descendant groups in tropical rainforests and identified hotspots where protections should increase. The report reveals why ensuring land rights for these groups are critical to efforts to conservation. Andy White, coordinator of Rights and Resources Initiative, is one of the report's authors. He tells Ricky Schreier why parts of Eastern Congo, the Congo Basin, Cameroon, Central African Republic, and Western Africa should be areas of interest in helping indigenous groups secure land rights.
Liberia would be another one where, since after the war, there's been lots of new laws to recognize community rights, but have not yet been implemented or just in the early stages of being implemented. And those are high biodiversity areas as well. So I'd say Central Africa and then West Africa. I don't know, East Africa as well. Kenya has a new law that hasn't been fully implemented or barely implemented to recognize community rights. And of course, wildlife and wildlife conservation are central to the identity of Kenya, the economy of Kenya, the tourism trade, et cetera, et cetera. So there's no lack of hot spots, if you will, in sub-Saharan Africa for recognizing rights and securing conservation for local people and for the countries themselves.
What are some of the biggest threats to biodiversity in these areas? While governments maybe in some of these countries are slow to implement these laws, I think in a lot of the places it is given knowledge that the local indigenous communities are better at protecting biodiversity.
So what's constraining them, or what's the biggest threat right now? I think it's a mix of, in some places it's the drive for more energy and infrastructure. For example, in Kenya, the wind, the geothermal, the pipelines, the things like that are seen as not only important for the economic development of the country, but also to restart the economies. So in some places, the biggest threats are this infrastructure and energy development. And in other places, it's just kind of land grabbing, so to speak, for agricultural development. And that'd be oil palm in Central and West Africa. Both of them are driven in short by people's local elite, if you will, or government elite's desires for economic development.
What is that balance strike between people in the U.S. or Europe, where the indigenous communities' rights often were, or especially in North America, I think their rights and their land usage was taken away, and the country then economically kind of thrived for many people anyway. And now, these other countries want to advance, quote unquote, economically, or how does it strike a balance when people are asking them to conserve these areas that they might see as places, as ways going forward?
Yeah, Ricky, that is a great question. I'm so glad you asked that question, because I think one of the big things we've learned in recent history is that's a false dichotomy. It's not one or the other. So, for example, in many countries now, Australia, increasingly in the U.S., Canada, you have situations where indigenous rights are recognized for the land or self-determination, and they choose to conserve, they choose to exploit their resources for energy, et cetera. So the communities as owners can choose, and often do choose, to be the counterparties for investors for energy development.
That was Andy White, coordinator of Rights and Resources Initiative. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Washington, D.C. And that is it for this Wednesday, September 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Button in Washington saying, have a good day.